The Spectator magazine is the greatest magazine in the English language. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online to see for yourselves. Also, against my advice as editor, we're giving away a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Given that you're spending 12 quid, you can do the maths. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. But don't hurry, because this offer probably loses us money.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, pondering her decision to appear on Celebrity SAS, Rachel Johnson reads her diary for the week. As the debate around political freebies continues, James Heal analyses the true value of Labour peer Lord Ali. As the crisis in the Middle East continues to escalate, Paul Wood questions if Israel is trying to drag America into a war with Iran. Reviewing Want, Sexual Fantasies, collated by Gillian Anderson, Rowan Pelling wonders whether some sexual fantasies should never be shared. And finally, Graham Thompson explores the ethics behind the publication of new music posthumously. Up first, Rachel Johnson.
"Use," a train cleaner in rubber gloves says as we arrive at Liverpool Lime Street. "What are yous doing here?" He's grinning and holding up the political journalists and delegates dribbling from the Euston train like a leaky hose. Behind me waits Tim Shipman, the consummate chronicler of conservative political chaos. I once sent Ship as a photograph of me sitting between my brothers Boris and Joe in a row on a cream chintz sofa at evening, all holding his hardback, Fallout, a Year of Political Mayhem. It was 2017. Instead of exchanging books we had written, as is the family Christmas custom, everyone had given each other his. Those were the days to be a hack, eh? Or a politician. Drama, box office, action. This year, it's Labour's first party conference in power. And instead of Tory chaos, there will be grim sacrifice and struggle ahead. Ours. More Unser Kampf than mine. In answer to the cleaner's existential question, one I have so often been asked in many and varied settings, I confess, Labour Party conference? He pulls up a sleeve to reveal an elaborate Special Forces tattoo spreading blue on his bicep. "I was in the SAS too," he announces, as if we are brothers in arms. On the way to the docks in the drizzle, I explain to a faintly puzzled Shippers — his new book, by the way, is about the exits of the last four prime ministers and is titled Out — that I'm appearing on Celebrity SAS Who Dares Wins on Channel 4. Then the conversation turns to the big topic, the buffet of evening options. There's the rally for Labour feminists, the rally for the Labour movement for Europe, the Statesman Party in the museum, the Tony Blair thing. Tim has a corporate, and I have to decide whether to go to the Spectator party or back to my hotel to watch myself on television, although I do not say this out loud. My principle of doing reality TV shows is that you should never watch them before you attach your name. If you did, you'd never sign up, and never watch them afterwards either. It's too awful. Plus, the Spectator party is Paul Roger at the Pullman. The correctness of my decision is confirmed by those watching Celebrity SAS So I Don't Have To. All you're allowed to take into camp is pants and bra. There is no hair and makeup. We are being trained for winter warfare in the New Zealand Alps, and it's so cold the water has frozen so nobody washes, apart from the daily waterboarding in freezing lakes. I might add that glamour is also in very short supply in Liverpool, even though Rachel Reeves's Barnet is super glossy and Emily Maitlis is in strappy gold stilettos at the Spectator party. I check my phone as I walk back to my hotel. Episode 1 ends with all the recruits having to storm a house where a hostage is being held as bombs go off, save him and shoot his captors. "Totally hooked and desperate for you to make it," texts the former health secretary and last season Celebrity SAS veteran Matt Hancock. The critic Camilla Long warns me as a friend that I look like the wreck of the Deutschland throughout. My father is even more loyal. I loved it when you shot the hostage, he writes. The actual truth of the matter is I'm here to make contacts as my LBC show has moved to a weekday, Friday at 7 p.m, and grab women from my global podcast, Difficult Women. In that, at least, it's mission accomplished. However, my secret theory about the huge success of audio is this. Most people use podcasts and audiobooks as sleep aids. If in need of a power nap during the day, I play Ukraine the Latest, the peerless daily podcast on Putin's war, and I'm often spark out before the thrumming instrumental intro segues into Storm Shadows. The rest is history is my alternate choice. The bridge writer and player, Susanna Gross, told me that she was recently discussing this very device with the novelist Ian McEwan. We both listened to audiobooks to help us sleep. We swapped suggestions, she told me. He was listening to Bertrand Russell's A History of Western Philosophy, and I recommended Bunny Tales, Behind Closed Doors at the Playboy Mansion. I wanted to end by saying something about the scrumptious forthcoming teleseries Rivals, but I had to sign an NDA, sigh, at the screening, so can't. Dame Gilly Cooper and Disney can't mind me revealing that my viewing pleasure was unconfined. And although you see willies as warned, Dame Gilly's works are not so much about sex or power, but money, class and taste. Shiveringly brilliant.
That was Rachel Johnson. Now, James Heal.
As a peer who hates publicity, Lord Ali might have been expected to dodge the Labour conference, given the near constant coverage of Donorgate. Yet there he was, clad in his 1990s tele-executive uniform of white trainers and dark suit, nonchalantly strolling around Liverpool. It was public confirmation of what Ali's friends say privately, that brushes with the press won't deter him from bankrolling the party he's financed for 25 years. Ali, who was thought to be worth £200 million, has found himself the unwelcome centre of attention over his gifts to members of the cabinet. He gave clothes and spectacles to the Starmers. He granted Angela Rayne the use of his luxury Manhattan apartment on New Year's Eve. He's funded David Lammy's staff, gifted Steve Reed a pair of £420 leather line wellies, and bankrolled Bridget Phillipson's 40th birthday party. His donations to the party have totaled more than £700,000 to date. Various excuses were mounted this week in defence of Ali's donations. It is a noble pursuit, just like giving to charity. We don't recognise that enough, declared Wes Streeting, for whom Ali once threw a £4,500 fundraising dinner attended by actors Sir Ian McKellen and Michael Cashman. It is difficult to overstate Ali's importance to Labour. His donations make up just part of his contribution. His bulging contacts book enables him to play a leading role in tapping up others. As chair of Labour's election fundraising, he uses £18 million London penthouse to host weekly meetings to plot donation drives. Such was his familiarity with Starmer's team that no one thought it odd that he was given a number 10 pass and hosted a thank you party in Downing Street, a decision which sparked claims of cash for access at the heart of government. Friends insist that such fears are wide of the mark. He's had a seat in the Lords since 1998, says one. What more could he want? Ali's efforts for Starmer echo the work he did in the halcyon days of New Labour. In the 1990s, it was Tony Blair ringing Ali for advice on youth appeal and Peter Mandelson using his Kent mansion to plot campaigns. On election night 2024, Starmer watched the exit poll from Ali's penthouse. Ali has always been one of Labour's moderates. He talks fondly of helping the party battle its militant wing in the 1980s. It was Emily Thornberry, then living on the same street, who encouraged her East End neighbour to take a greater role in the 1990s. Ennoblement as the first openly gay peer enabled him to lead the charge against Section 28 in the Upper House. His attendance since then, though, has been sporadic. He's given barely a dozen speeches in the past decade. Ali prefers to instead operate behind the scenes, as he keeps the money taps flowing, even though, under Jeremy Corbyn, the flow became little more than a trickle. His fabulous wealth comes from several fortunes. The first was built in the 1980s, earning £1,000 a day as a financial consultant in the era of Thatcherite yuppiedom. The second came in 1992, when he teamed up with Bob Geldof and Charlie Parsons to launch TV production company Planet 24. Hits kept coming, The Word, Survivor and The Big Breakfast, leading one newspaper to dub Ali the man who perfected TV presented by morons for morons. Further millions came from property, online retail and media rights. Not bad for a boy whose career as officer suggested he become a bus conductor. Such wealth is lavished on Ali's friends and contacts. Former staff talk of birthday cards and Christmas gifts, of Prada bags and Paul Smith shirts. His parties are the stuff of legend. At Planet 24, he and Parsons once lit up the huge Ark building in West London with lasers. Guests talk fondly of the annual bash at his Kent Pile, a Ferris wheel, dodgems and hot air balloon have all featured. Rich, sociable and a lifelong opponent of the far left, it's no surprise that the current cabinet is willing to look past the scathing headlines and keep supporting Ali. For all the endless questions about his donations, ministers at the Labour conference know his value. "We need more like him in Labour, not less," said one. On Monday, the party hosted its biggest ever business event at its conference. More than 500 lobbyists and executives shelled out £3,000 a ticket to mingle with ministers and swell party coffers. Ali helped coordinate donors. Keeping business on side was one of the major subplots to the conference. Reeve sought to reassure wary executives over her plans to give workers more rights, insisting she wanted her growth plan to be co-written with business. More details will be unveiled in the coming weeks, but until their budget on 30th of October, many fear the government is still in its phony war period. Reeve's conference speech was light on details, and a green paper on industrial strategy is not expected until next year. "It's good talk," said one lobbyist, "but we need the detail." Some suggest that this strong corporate presence is partly responsible for the muted atmosphere at conference, despite a record attendance. "These are not natural party supporters or activists. They're here for work, so of course they're not going to be enthused," suggests one Labour MP. Other aides felt that having so many lobbyists undermined the sense of conference being centred around thanking the Labour family. It was left to the Prime Minister to end the conference on a more rousing note. His speech on Tuesday afternoon, the first by a Labour Premier at conference for 15 years, was not one for the history books, but gave activists something to cheer, sausage gaff aside. "It did what needed to be done," was the near universal consensus afterwards. Having begun the conference on Sunday with bad headlines by Ali and Sue Gray, Starmer ended stronger than he started. "It resets things without using the word reset," said one MP afterwards. Downing Street will now try to draw a line under the donation scandal and tensions within Number 10, yet political reality might make both impossible. As long as Labour needs benefactors, Lord Ali and his millions will continue to be part of the story.
That was James Heal. Next, Paul Wood.
The American general David Petraeus famously asked of the invasion of Iraq, "Tell me how this ends." That's the question as Israeli bombs and missiles fall on Lebanon, and the few missiles Hezbollah has sent in response are intercepted. Iraq's axis of resistance, as it's called, seems paralysed with indecision. Does Benjamin Netanyahu take this as a win, the vindication of the enormous chance he took by opening a new northern front? Or, like a gambler intoxicated by success at the tables, does he press on? More airstrikes, followed by an invasion of Lebanon, and then the bombers fly on to Iran. Some Israeli commentators are already calling this the Third Lebanon War, after the wars of 1982 to 2000 and 2006. That's a fair description, given how many Lebanese have been killed, at least 600 at the time of writing. How long these punishing airstrikes continue depends in part on how many of Hezbollah's rockets have been destroyed and how many Israel's war cabinet believe must be destroyed before the campaign can pause. One Israeli journalist, Ben Caspit, tweeted to say a political source was briefing that half of Hezbollah's long-range rockets were gone, but the military had said otherwise and that, quote, "most of the work is still ahead of us," close quote. A convincing win for Netanyahu would be for the intense American mediation efforts underway to produce a new understanding with Hezbollah, one that ends rocket fire into northern Israel. Those efforts are being led by an Israeli-American former businessman, Amos Hochstein, who once served in the Israeli Defense Forces. He doesn't talk directly to Hezbollah because it's proscribed by the US as a terrorist group. Instead, he goes through Shiite politicians in Lebanon. The message to them and to Hezbollah is said to be that the US won't be able to restrain Israel if it comes to an all-out war. Israel wants Hezbollah to pull back from the border to the far side of the Litani River, as called for by UN Resolution 1701, which set the terms for the end of the 2006 war. Such a move could be a humiliation too far for Hezbollah and might be impossible for it to swallow, especially if it results in the outcome Israel is trying to achieve, the end of mortar and rocket fire over the border. Hezbollah has been doing this in support of Hamas in Gaza since the day after October the 7th. To stop now would be an admission that the axis of resistance has been broken. First, though, honour might require Hezbollah to make a show of revenge for the hundreds of dead and thousands of casualties in its ranks. One option, it could simply lie to save face. Last month, Hezbollah claimed a triumph in avenging the targeted killing by Israel of one of its most senior commanders, Fuad Shukr. They said that hundreds of Katyusha rockets had cleared the way for drones to hit two of Israel's most sensitive intelligence sites, one a complex of Mossad buildings, the other the headquarters of Unit 8200, which is responsible for cyber warfare. With typical theatricality, Hezbollah named the operation for and carried it out on Arbayin, the last of 40 days of mourning for Hussein, grandson of the Prophet and one of Shia Islam's greatest heroes. Unfortunately, the Tehran Times was almost alone in reporting that the operation had actually worked, saying that 22 Israelis were killed and 74 injured. Other outlets did not have this news. Hezbollah's leader, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, gave a defiant speech. He said, "Our data confirms that a significant number of drones reached these two targets, but the enemy is keeping its secret." That trick might not work again. In which case, would Hezbollah be goaded into using its arsenal of long-range missiles hidden deep underground? Until now, the Party of God has been restrained by public opinion in Lebanon, which has always been furiously opposed to anything that might provoke Israel into full-scale war. But views may have shifted with the terror and anger caused when Hezbollah's pagers blew up in their hands all over Lebanon. It was a targeted attack, but many innocent bystanders were hurt too. A headline in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz said, "Israelis should watch the footage from Lebanon with repulsion and fear, not glee." On Wednesday morning, Hezbollah fired a missile at Tel Aviv for the first time. It was destroyed mid-air by another missile from the Iron Dome defence system. Fear, or at least a healthy respect for Israel's capabilities, may be governing Hezbollah's calculations. Over the past few days, Israel has demonstrated its military superiority. That goes for Iran too. Iran's ancient air force would certainly come off worst in any clash with Israel's squadrons of F-35s, now dominating the skies over Lebanon. The Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian, told journalists at the UN in New York, "We don't want to fight, we don't want war, we want to live in peace." A report on the US political website Axios quoted Israeli officials as saying Iran had rebuffed a plea from Hezbollah to attack Israel. The timing wasn't right. After you, no, after you. Perhaps the most likely outcome then is a brief upsurge of violence, including some ineffective retaliation by Hezbollah, followed by a new calm, with Israel much stronger than before. But that depends, to no small extent, on Netanyahu's intentions. Netanyahu believes himself to be Israel's man of destiny, the country's Churchill, who understands threats that no one else perceives, the only one who knows what has to be done to ensure the country's survival. He's argued many times over his long political career that a nuclear-armed Iran would be an existential threat to Israel, and Iran may be closer than ever to getting such a weapon. Some of Netanyahu's critics and some of his friends believe he's been manoeuvring all along to attack Iran and to drag the US into such a war. The chess pieces are being positioned in a way that fits. First, open the Northern Front. Second, humiliate Hezbollah so it takes the bait. Then brace for the kind of attack that would demand action against Hezbollah's backers in Tehran. Finally, call on the US to make sure Israel survives the wider Middle Eastern war that follows. President Joe Biden is said to have privately voiced fears that this is exactly what Netanyahu is trying to do, according to a well-sourced report on NBC. Israel could win such a war, as it's demonstrating now in Lebanon, but at terrible cost to its enemies and to itself.
That was Paul Wood. Now, Rowan Palling.
Sexual fantasies, that dream you had last night, and ideas for novels have one thing in common. Generally, the best place for them is inside your head, never to be divulged. Until now, the major exception to the rule was Nancy Friday's 1973 compilation of women's fantasies, My Secret Garden, which sold more than 2 million copies worldwide. Friday aimed to emancipate women from guilt and inhibition, and informed an enthralled world that women of all stripes were prone to vivid erotic reverie. Many of the more heavily thumbed passages involve taboo elements, such as rape, incest, and the occasional dog or octopus. Of course, this was some decades before the internet, and it's possible that not every reader engaged with the book out of entirely feminist principles. 50 years later, in our sexually saturated era, The Case for Want, a collection of contemporary women's erotic fantasies curated by Gillian Anderson, may feel rather less urgent, although the actress says that many of her correspondents are still yoked to shame. Even so, the topics in Want are more rigorously policed for a Me Too generation. Anderson makes it clear that there's nothing downright illegal here. No beasts, well, unless you count Bigfoot. And dodgier scenarios come with caveats along the lines of, naturally, I would not want this in real life. But I'm sure the book will attract plenty of enthusiastic readers. Some will be drawn by anthropological interest, others by that age-old preoccupation. Are my private thoughts normal? Yet others will seek good old-fashioned erotic jollies. Happily for them, much of the X-rated material makes Anais Nin look like a shrinking violet. There are threesomes, orgies, exhibitionism, voyeurism, and plenty of power games from the E.L. James playbook. Of course, many will be attracted by the fact their fantasies aren't a million miles removed from Anderson herself. Few actresses command the breadth of intellectual and erotic admiration she does. She's talked of a relationship she had with a woman in her early acting days. Gen Z fans sung her praises after she starred as the sex therapist Dr. G. Milburn in the TV series Sex Education, a role which granted her honorary sexpert status. When Anderson pays homage to Friday in Want's introduction, while setting out her own criteria and methodology for this new compilation, it could be Milburn talking. The actress made an appeal through her publishers for women to write to her via a special online portal with their most intimate imaginings set out as letters, using the preface, Dear Gillian. She duly received enough material for a 1,000-page book, which she whittled down to a torrent of unbridled passion from across the world. They included scenarios from young and old, straight and gay, religious and atheist, from Nigeria to New Zealand. Some basic demographic details were also requested, and mostly supplied. Nationality, income, relationship status, religious belief, sexuality, and whether the writer had children. I imagine a lot of trust was involved in this exercise, as every contributor is strictly anonymous. An astonishing number of contributors describe themselves as bisexual, pansexual, and/or pagan, which, added to the lesbian contingent, far outnumber the boring old straight fantasists. This also suggests that the sample is highly representative of an Anderson army. One popular meme on social media bears the legend, Gillian Anderson made me gay. Among this non-hetero cohort, one fascinating subset of fantasies introduced me to the term huckow, or human cow, where your sexual delight hinges on imagining yourself being milked and prized for your breeding abilities. One typical entry ran, My deepest fantasy is to be impregnated, to be bred over and over, kept pregnant, and used for nothing more than for a man's pleasure. I fantasize about being milked. Suffice it is to say, there's a lot of lactation in this book. But nothing's new under the sun. Guy de Maupassant's erotic short story, Idyll, involves a starving young man who meets a wet nurse on a train, with a predictable denouement. What is new is that it's women, and often childless, gay or bisexual women, who find lactation such a turn-on. Just as they seem to find the idea, if not the practice, of unprotected sex with a man arousing. What this reaffirms is that every generation finds its own taboos according to its strict social mores. Straightforward infidelity was far hotter when fidelity was socially enforced. And now that many women are lesbians or pansexual, genderqueer, and not having babies to save the planet from overpopulation, the biggest act of transgression appears to be sleeping with a bloke or falling pregnant. Also scoring high on the verboten scale was the woman who wanted to be kidnapped by a terrorist organisation. So what did I take away from Want? First, don't read it in one sitting unless you want the fantasy equivalent of feeling you've eaten an entire gatto. Even the most skilled editor can't help the fact that a mass of torrid daydreams gets quite samey after a while. There's also no accounting for taste. Women variously lusted after the Weasley twins from Harry Potter, Harry Styles, their brother-in-law, a five-foot empress, female pirates, a dentist, a vampire, strangers on trains, and tellingly, themselves. Lapsed religious types often wanted priests, monks, or even an illicit affair with a pastor's wife. Some spectator readers may be reassured to learn that there's even someone whose turn-on is being chosen by a wealthy businessman to be of service to him for a year. Perhaps the fantasy that touched me most was the woman who said she had no hang-ups and had enjoyed good sex, but still longed to be ravaged by a tall German man, made so exhausted from pleasure that I cannot stand for days. I had a hard relate and might even have yelped the words, Michael Fassbinder.
That was Rowan Palling, and finally, Graham Thompson.
At the record company meeting, on their hands at last, a dead star. Back when Morrissey was more concerned with writing a decent lyric than sour internet tirades, Paint a Vulgar Picture by the Smiths summed it all up rather neatly. A living pop star is all well and good, but a dead one is far less troublesome and considerably more profitable. Some artists only really get going once they're dead. Commercially speaking, Eva Cassidy's entire career has been posthumous, the Van Gogh of the lustreless Radio 2 ballad. Death has been a boon to the pop industry since the year dot. Buddy Holly's It Doesn't Matter Anymore and Eddie Cochran's Three Steps to Heaven reached number one in 1959 and 1960 respectively, hot on the heels of their untimely demise. Otis Redding's Sitting on the Dock of the Bay was rush-released in January 1968, shortly after the soul singer died in a plane crash. Redding regarded the song as unfinished and had plans to re-record it. Stax put it out anyway. Which brings us to the heart of the matter. The recycling of existing product, however scrappy, after an artist dies, is a given. Tupac Shakur released 4 albums while alive and at least 7 dead. David Bowie's career is considerably busier than it was in the decade before his passing in 2016. From Elvis to Amy, the beat goes on. More contentious is the completion and release of work which is unfinished when a musician dies. This is the case with 2 new album releases. Acclaimed and influential British electronic musician Sophie died in 2021, aged 34, from an accidental fall. Her second album, Sophie, has been completed by her brother Benny Long, who worked as her recording engineer with the assistance of their sister Emily. An almost constant presence alongside Sophie in the studio, Long worked from the provisional 16-song track list he discussed with her. For many of the songs, only final mixing and mastering was required. Others were less formed and were built up from sketches and demos. Creative decisions typically signed off by the artists were by necessity made by those closest to her. This merging of family and musical ties reminded me that when George Harrison died in November 2001, he'd been working intermittently on his first studio album since 1987. As his health declined and knowing that he wouldn't complete the work in time, Harrison left detailed instructions for his son Danny and his friend and producer, EOL's Jeff Lynne, to become the executors of his rock and roll will. A year after his death, Brainwashed Julie appeared, sounding remarkably like a pretty decent George Harrison album. In the kind of ironic twist he may have appreciated, death gave Harrison the impetus to finish a record he might have continued dithering over had he remained alive. In Harrison's case, he knew he was dying and could delegate accordingly. Sophie died suddenly and tragically. Nobody will ever quite know for sure what route her music may have taken had she lived. She may have met new collaborators, scrapped her demos, started afresh. Sophie can only ever be a highly educated guess at what her second album might have sounded like. But the motive feels pure. A family's wish to keep their sibling alive through her art and to fulfill her known creative impulses as best they can. It comes down to, would she want this album to come out or would she not? Long recently told the New York Times. And she definitely would. Long has stated that there will be no further albums. Sophie certainly feels more ethically sound than a dead John Lennon, unwittingly contributing some squeaky old demos to create three new Beatles singles. Or the remaining members of The Doors taking some dodgy poetry readings by Jim Morrison, dubbing on new music and releasing it as an American prayer 7 years after Morrison's death. AI will soon bring every dead singer back to life in the most unedifying ways. But music isn't the sole culprit. Numerous authors, from Tolkien to David Foster Wallace to John le Carré, have had major works compiled and published posthumously without their consent. Back to the Smiths. The group's former bass player Andy Rourke died last year. When he fell ill, he'd been working with Cav Sandu in Blitz Vega. Sandu promised his friend that he would complete the album they'd spent years working on. And he has. Northern Gentleman is out this week. Fair enough. Rourke was a musician, and musicians want their work to be heard. Would Rourke be happy with the final iteration of this committed blend of rock and roll, glam, trashy punk, and electronica? Sandu thinks so, and he's surely the best place to comment. He's very probably right. The trouble is, no one will ever quite know for sure.
And that's everything for this week. For more articles, pick up a copy of The Spectator magazine or check out our website. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd really appreciate a rate or review. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.